It's on.
Okay. Hey, good morning, everyone. We're really in the middle of a very, very interesting story. You'll recall that there is a debate whether the Tefillat Arvit, the davening of Maariv, the Amida of Arvit, is a reshus, is it an optional mitzvah, or is it an obligatory mitzvah? And a certain anonymous Talmud, whose name is not given till the very end of the story, the great and celebrated Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, first asks Rabbi Yoshua, Rishus Ochova, Rabbi Yoshua answers Rishus. He then asks Rabban Gamliel, the head of the Sanhedrin, Rishus Ochova, Rabban Gamliel says Chova. And when Rav Shimon bar Yochai then tells him what your colleague Rabbi Yeshua says Rishus, so you will recall what happened. There is a convocation of the Sanhedrin or of the yeshiva. It's not clear which body is being convened. And Rabbi Yeshua is forced, as it were, to stand up during the entire shiur. The Gemara tells us this was the third time that Rabban Gamliel had embarrassed Rabbi Yehoshua in this manner. One time was Rabbi Yeshua had a different calculation for Rosh Hashanah and therefore Yom Kippur, and Rabban Gamliel ordered him to carry money on the day that was Rabbi Yeshua's Yom Kippur. The second time he actually stood up again because there was some question whether if a Kohen is in possession of a firstborn animal that has a blemish, is the Kohen believed to say that the blemish was accidental? Because if it was accidental, the Kohen could shech the animal and eat it. If it was intentional, he would not be allowed to do so. And although a Yisrael is normally believed to say it was an accident, because the Yisrael gets no benefit. The Yisrael has to give it to a Kohen, but a Kohen has an ulterior motive. Once again, there was a disagreement. Rabbi Yeshua had to stand up. And the third is Tefillas Arvit. So what there is in this case is, there is a palace revolt. The disciples, now these are Talmidei Chachamim, these are not like young yeshiva students, the disciples feel that Rabban Gamliel is too high-handed, he is not showing respect for Talmidei Chachamim, he is autocratic, he is dictatorial, and as a result they decide that he has to be impeached, he has to be removed from his office. But the question, it's a very interesting idea, because normally we would not conceive of a Rosh Yeshiva, or certainly the head of the Sanhedrin, being amenable to impeachment and removal from office. But I do want to tell you, and Rabbi Wein could probably give you a lot more detail than I, that even in the world of the yeshivas of the 19th century, sometimes the yeshiva students would replace Rosh Yeshivas and the like, if they didn't like. So in the Volozhiner Yeshiva, which at one time, the Netziv was the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin for 50 years, and at one time, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was the co-Rosh Yeshiva. And before Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, his father, the Beis Halevi, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and for various reasons, there were some disagreements between them, although the Gedolim themselves, as is always the case, made shalom, but some of the followers did not. And the Yeshiva went on strike in protest to the way the Netziv was interacting with the Soloveitchiks, and they closed down the Yeshiva. So indeed, there were palace revolts, and perhaps their precedent was the Gemara in Brachos. Now, Rav Kook explains the following idea. Rav Kook tries to explain that it is inconceivable, and we will have textual proofs to this effect as we go through the story, that Rabban Gamliel was simply a Baal Gaiva. You know, if one wants to look at things superficially, one would say, hey, Chas v'shalom, he's a very arrogant person. He's a high-handed person. He doesn't allow people to disagree with him, and not only does he not allow disagreement, but he embarrasses them and humiliates them. Right? You get that impression. But Rav Kook says it's not really conceivable that such a person would even become a Nasi. Keep in mind that Rabban Gamliel is a great-great grandson of Hillel, an unbroken. All the Nasiim were the descendants of Hillel. And although that's not a guarantee, but we know that one of the outstanding features of Hillel's personality was his gentleness, his modesty, his humility. I think I mentioned last week the famous story, Masechet Shabbos, Lamed Aleph Amid Beis, when people made a bet they would get Hillel angry, and they came to him Friday afternoon while he was bathing and washing his hair, and this guy asked all sorts of ridiculous questions, and then he didn't. Then he kept on coming back. Hillel goes back into the room where he's washing himself, and every 15 minutes, another question, another question, another question, another question. And finally the person says, "Are you the Hillel that's the Nasi?" Obviously he knew he was. And Hillel says, "Yeah, that's who I am." He says, "I hope there's no one else like you in the world." He says, "Why?" He says, "Because you cost me 400 gold pieces. I made a bet I could get you angry, and I lost the bet." And Hillel says, "Better that you should lose 400 gold pieces than I should lose my temper." So Hillel is the outstanding example of humility, of patience, of tolerance. In fact, the very famous statement that one should strive to be like the Talmidim of Aaron, one should follow the example of Aaron HaKohen, to be Ohev Shalom, a lover of peace, a Rodev Shalom, a pursuer of peace, Ohev Es HaBrios, one who loves all of God's creations. And by the way, since it says the word Brios and not Yisrael, apparently he is including Jews and non-Jews in that statement, and perhaps it's even including animals. You know, you love all that God made, umakarban l'Torah, and in that way, you will bring them to the Torah. You bring them to the Torah by love and by acceptance. So Rav Kook says it was inconceivable that Rabban Gamliel was simply arrogant in a personal way. And again, as we go through the story, I'll show you some proofs that he has from the story itself. But he says Rabban Gamliel is really facing a difficult dilemma. And again, I'm just reiterating some points we made last week in more detail. That is, remember that this is the Rabban Gamliel who is called Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. His grandfather was Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, and he is Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. Rabban Gamliel HaZaken lived in the waning years of the Second Temple. Rabban Gamliel of Yavne, right? Remember what Yavne is. Yavne was the place of refuge that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai asked Vespasian to spare, where the Jewish people were trying to regroup after the awesome destruction of the temple. And Rabban Gamliel is presiding over a nation that has been virtually destroyed with the Chorban Beis HaMikdash and the Golos. And remember, it's not just the destruction of the temple, as awesome as that was, obviously, something we still mourn about. But thousands and thousands of Jews were murdered, sold into slavery, forcibly taken out of their land. The great yeshivos were decimated. There were so many great rabbis. It really was a Holocaust. Now, numerically, I cannot tell you 6 million people died. It was probably much less than that. But in terms of spiritual life, Am Yisrael was devastated. And Rabban Gamliel is trying to figure out how to maintain a Jewish nation, physically and spiritually, at a time when we have undergone such great calamities and tragedies. And the answer that he has is, there needs to be a strong leader. There needs to be a person who unifies people. There needs to be a person that's respected and accepted. And we can't have different opinions, different views, because although in a healthy time, perhaps that is healthy, it's good to have diversity, it's good to have discussion. But he felt, if the Jewish people break off into too many segments, where each one does his own thing, we're not going to be able to build a nation. In other words, Rav Kook says, Rav Gamliel would concede that in a normal, healthy time, it's fine to have all of these different views. But in the aftermath of the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, you need a leader. There has to be one voice. People have to know they're part of a nation. One could imagine, for example, right after the Holocaust. At that point, you know, people didn't do their own thing so much. We had to build yeshivas, we had to build kollelim, we had to build shuls. Families had to get reestablished again. It wasn't a time to march to your own drummer or seek individuality. Now, well, this is a current issue. Now we could say, now maybe we're ready to look in different drachim, and that's why you see within Klal Yisrael there are many different rivulets and currents. Some controversy about that too, because some got used to the old way of lockstep within the religious community and the like. So Rav Kook says The fundamental disagreement between Rabban Gamliel and everybody else is what is the appropriate leadership style to keep the Jewish people together. Rabban Gamliel's message is strong, decisive, unquestioning leadership. And that way people will build what they have to build. The Talmidim, and Rabbi Yeshua, by the way, didn't argue with Rabban Gamliel. You'll notice Rabbi Yeshua, when he's simply told to stand in the corner, like a five-year-old who has time out, he just does it. I mean, it's interesting. He's not the one that creates this revolt. He just does it. But everybody else is revolting, and Rav Kook says they are presenting a different shita. And we'll see who's right. Their shita is that the way you reach people is by creating an atmosphere not only of tolerance, which is a general idea, but a particular atmosphere of respect for individual Talmidei Chachamim. Because what you're doing is the following. By giving every Talmid Chacham respect, people then know they can look to different rabbis and different sources for Hadracha. And the power of the Talmid Chacham over society, Rav Kook says, is not one of coercion by reason of his position, but it would then persuade by reason of their personality and their goodness. In other words, the Talmidim are basically saying that people are not going to be changed by official positions. They will be changed by the personalities of greatness that they encounter. But in order for them to encounter such personalities, we have to have a society that is machshiv them. So in a sense, the role of a leader is not to be the boss. The role of the leader is to create an atmosphere where people respect Talmidei Chachamim and teachers, which will then allow those teachers to influence people by love and persuasion rather than coercion. So there is a role for a leader, but the role of the leader is to make other people look good. And that's actually, if you read Lahavdil, books on business, you will always find that one of the most successful management techniques, now you have some bosses who take credit for everything that goes good, and anything that goes wrong, they blame somebody else for, right? So they take none of the blame, and they take all of the credit. In reality, that's not going to be a very successful management strategy, because at some point, you know, your employees are simply have no incentive to put out for you. But there's a different type of management style, which is a collaborative management style in which each person feels, at least we're talking about maybe higher management, but even on lower levels, each person feels they are a stakeholder in the success of the enterprise. Each person feels their contributions are treasured and valued, and they do better. So Rav Kook says the Talmidim are taking the position. You, Rabban Gamliel, may think that to rebuild in the aftermath of Chorban, we have to have autocratic leadership. In reality, it would work much, much better if individual Talmidei Chachamim would be given respect, and then their influence would be felt throughout the community as a matter of love and Kavod HaTorah, rather than autocratic leadership. By contrast, you, Rabban Gamliel, see, Kardeshim Rav Kook is making a deeper point here. It's not simply they're deposing Rabban Gamliel because he disrespected a Talmid Chacham. It's more than that. They're basically saying, by your disrespect for individual Talmidei Chachamim, you are not fulfilling your job and your responsibility as a Nasi, because you are diluting the influence of Talmidei Chachamim in the broader community. Because people are now going to think, well, why should I respect my local rabbi? Why should I respect, you know, this Talmid Chacham in my neighborhood? The Nasi doesn't respect him. Why should I? So you see Rav Kook's subtlety. The issue of deposing Rabban Gamliel is not simply he did a bad thing, but rather he is literally not fulfilling his role as a Nasi, and therefore they feel they have to replace him. This is what Rav Kook says. And again, like everything Rav Kook writes in the Ein Yaakov here, in the Ein Ayah, obviously he's writing very much aware of the current issues that he was involved in, and issues that we are very much involved in. And indeed, he sees in the Gemara stories, he sees really a prism and a reflection of contemporary issues. And this is what we learn Agadata, well, not the only reason, but this is one of the reasons we learn Agadata, because it gives us perspectives as to how to view. Within the Torah world today, whether it's a Haredi, Dati, Lumi, whatever division you want to make, I don't have to get into specific divisions, there is indeed this very, very big debate in some ways. Do you want centralized authority? Lahavdil, to be somewhat irreverent, a Jewish pope, although the pope is no longer a central authority even in Catholicism anymore. Do you want a central, for example, I'll give you an example. When Rav Yoshev was Nifter, there was a lot of talk, some of it was in the popular press, but some of it was in the Torah world. Who should be the leader of the Lithuanian camp, the non-Hasidic yeshiva camp, the leader? And it turned, again, I really don't want to go here too much, but I'll just dip my toes in the water. It turned into an extremely vituperative blood feud involving Talmidim, not the Gedolim themselves, involving Talmidim of Rav Shmuel Orbach and Rav Chaim Kanievsky, a Yerushalayim B'nai Barak squabble. Now, if anybody here could tell me what a profound philosophical difference exists between Rav Shmuel Orbach and Rav Chaim Kanievsky, you are a smarter person than I am. Basically, there is no difference between them at all. But the question is, who should be the leader? And as you know, it's Machlokas. Who is the leader? But fundamentally, the question was raised, whoever said there was the leader? We have Gedolim, we have Talmidei Chachamim. We look to people that are learned, that are Balei Midos, of course, that have Abbas Yisrael. And there is a diversity of voices. And I'm not talking about the pluralism of, you know, conservative reform. I'm talking about, you know, within the Torah community. It was not understood there was a single leader. This is almost, I have to say, an Eretz Yisrael invention. This was not true in Europe. It really was not true even in the United States. And it was not true here until maybe 30 or 40 years ago, this concept of a leader. I mean, my mind is going in crazy places. I mean, I think of leader, I think of Führer. I mean, what is this idea of supreme leader? There was not such a concept. Even in the time of the Chafetz Chaim, who, if anybody, would be called the leader of Am Yisrael, he would be called the leader. There were many, many other Gedolim who took issue with the Chafetz Chaim at different times. Rav Meir Simcha, the Or Sameach, with Chaim Soloveitchik a little earlier, and the like. I mean, part of why the Chafetz Chaim, by the end of his life, was the undisputed leader is he simply lived longer than anyone else. I mean, everyone else died, like Rav Yashiv, Baruch Hashem, was Zeicha to Arichas Yomim. But there was not a concept when you had Gedolim, you know, in the generation, that there was a leader. So, what is so fascinating about this is that this is what Rav Kook is talking about. Rabban Gamliel maintained, you have to have a leader, otherwise people run in too many directions, and you don't have Achlus. But even Rabban Gamliel, this is the other thing, only said it in a time of cataclysm like the Churban. Even Rabban Gamliel might not apply it today, you know, who knows. But the Talmidim are making the other point. The Talmidim are making the point that having a single leader that denigrates other Talmidei Chachamim is actually a bad thing, because it prevents the influence of Torah from permeating among the Shderot Ha'am, among the all of the different people. And therefore, their argument is, your job is not to build yourself up as a leader. Your job is to build respect for Talmidei Chachamim, so they will be in a capacity to influence their communities, and you're not doing that. Lehepech, you're taking a great Talmud Chacham, you're humiliating him, so what is the man in the street supposed to say when he doesn't like what his Rav or his Posek says? And, oh, well, he's nothing, because I see Rabbi Gamliel treats other rabbis with total disrespect. Okay? So this is a very, very fascinating issue. It's very, very fascinating. It's so relevant. And this also indicates Rav Kook's own leadership style. Right? Rav Kook was officially the Rav HaRashi. Again, I don't have the exact date when he wrote this. I mean, you know, he started writing this when he was just in Yafo, but these are reflections that really are about the way he lived his life. And he had many, many misnagdim, many, many people who didn't feel that he should be in that position. Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, who was a personal friend, but nevertheless was ideologically very much against a lot of the shitas of Rav Kook. Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld was the essentially the founder of the Eid HaCharedis, which broke off, did not accept Rav Kook. This is pre-Medina, right? The Eid HaCharedis pre-existed in Medina, and Rav Kook's was the Rav HaRashi before the Medina. He died in the 1930s, and they didn't accept, etc. But Rav Kook's attitude always was, that if there are great Talmidei Chachamim that have different views, they should express their views. They should be able, as long as one does not denigrate, which unfortunately they did, as long as one does not hate, as long as there's mutual respect, Rav Kook said, I would never say Kablu Dati, you must accept my view. Klal Yisrael needs many, many different types of teachers and many, many different types of influences, again within the miskeret of Torah. And that's an interesting question. What is in and what is out? That is a very good question. But within the framework of the Torah, there are going to be different views. And this is literally the machlokas between Rabban Gamliel and the Talmidim. Right, very, very fascinating how Rav Kook reads this struggle into this very passage. Because without Rav Kook, we would have just learned that all this is he, Rabbi Gamliel, showed disrespect to somebody, so they were moving him because of his personal arrogance. Rav Kook says, no, there's a whole debate here about the appropriate standard of leadership. You know, it's interesting, by Yosef, it says by Yosef HaTzadik, that when Yosef was put in charge of Potiphar's house, so it says, Vayehi ish matzliach. Yosef was an ish matzliach. And if you look in every translation, it always says Yosef was successful. That's how it is translated. But I once heard from Rav Moshe Scherer, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the head of Aguda, a very legendary figure, that the literal grammatical translation of matzliach, although we use it today to mean successful, matzliach is to make other people successful. Matzliach. To be matzliach. And therefore, the key to Yosef's hatzlocha was he made other people feel successful, feel good, and therefore they were motivated to do their best job. And that made Yosef successful. Again, it's that management strategy that I talked about. And this is the role of a gadol as well. In fact, it's interesting that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, okay, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was certainly considered to be a phenomenal guy, and he was an older contemporary of Rav Kook. In fact, Rav Kook was a Talmud in Volozhin, Rav Chaim was a young Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is really considered to be the founder of the deep, analytical, advanced Talmudic analysis that we do in the highest yeshivas. Again, it's a whole difficult academic enterprise to say, well, what did Rav Chaim invent that wasn't done by Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the like? Okay, these are difficult questions, but Rav Chaim had a unique analytical derech. It's called the Brisker derech. And the truth of the matter is it's been diluted and distorted in many ways, but it is the fundamental derech of advanced learning in Talmudic analysis. And all of the great Rosh Yeshivas of the next generation, of the pre-World War II generation, were the Talmidim of Rav Chaim, whether it's Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, whether it was Rav Elchanan Wasserman, Rav Boruch Ber Leibovitch, all of these great Rosh Yeshivas, who in turn were the Rebbes of the later Rosh Yeshivas after the war. They all come from Rav Chaim. So really, the whole yeshiva learning comes from Rav Chaim. Rav Shimon Shkup, Rav Chaim was a great, great analytical mind, phenomenal mind. Although they do say that what was the shorish of Rav Chaim's derech? This is very cute, very interesting. The shorish of Rav Chaim's analytical derech was a man who gets no credit at all. I don't even know if we know his name. This was the melamed that he had when he was 8 or 9 years old. He was a slonim or chassid. And when he was teaching the children Gemara, he always made sure they could articulate exactly what the question is, what the answer is. So obviously it was not at an extremely deep level. But this notion of thinking through everything. All right, so what is the assumption here? And Rav Chaim like absorbed that as a young child from this Slonimer Magid, and then as he became greater and greater in Torah, he just took that basic structure. In fact, Einstein said that the key to being a great scientist is to still think like a child. Don't take things for granted. In a way, Rav Chaim is saying the same thing. You take, your adult abilities, but you try to have the same types of basic questions that a child would ask as well. So Rav Chaim himself said that he credited his derech to this anonymous Slonimer Chassid that was his melamed at 8 years old. So if any of you have children who teach young children, and you say, oh, gee, he was in Kolo for 20 years, why can't he be a Rosh Yeshiva? Keep in mind that the teacher of the young child may be creating something so permanent and so enduring, much more than the later Rosh Yeshiva. In fact, they say, just as an aside, that the Vilna Gaon gave great honor to the teacher who taught him Aleph Beis. Because he says, that's the one teacher who I know taught me the truth. Everything else, I don't know. He said, but the Aleph Beis I know is MS, Teres MS, for sure. Okay. All right. But that's the point. So why did I bring in Rav Chaim? I brought in Rav Chaim to make this point. That although Rav Chaim was such a phenomenally gifted analytical thinker, each of his great Talmidim took away a different approach. He did not make cookie cutter imitators. Rabbi Shimon Shkop's approach is different than Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman is different than Rabbi Baruch Ber. Rabbi Baruch Ber is different than Rabbi Isser Zalman. Because what is the sign of a great teacher? A great teacher is there to develop the individuality of each person. The goal is not imitate me or whatever it is. The goal of a great teacher is to help the person discover that which is unique and special in themselves. This is what Shlomo HaMelech says, Chanoch lenar al pi darko, train a child according to their derech. Everybody has a derech, and the goal of chinuch is to enable someone to discover their derech, not to impose my derech, but to enable them to discover their derech. That is why the ideal Jewish chinuch was parent to child, a one-to-one teacher-student ratio. It is only because it couldn't happen that, we had to have schools and everything else, yeshivos, but that was kind of the bidiyah. Okay. So be it as it may, this is the great debate in leadership style. Rabbi Gamliel says, achdus at all costs. And if that means I gotta be autocratic, I'm gonna do it. And they say, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Because ultimately, the influence of Torah will be conveyed by love when you've created a society where Talmidei Chachamim are respected and cherished and looked as a valuable resource. Okay, this is Rev Cook's Mahalach, and he's gonna take this Mahalach throughout the entire story. Okay. So the question now becomes, okay, if we're going to get rid of Rabban Gamliel, who shall be his replacement? So there are a few possibilities. The most obvious possibility is, of course, Rabbi Yoshua. But they don't want to do Rabbi Yoshua because he is involved in this controversy, so to speak. And the simple meaning would be, it would look too much like it's a personal grudge. In other words, they want to make, the Talmidim want to be very clear that this is a matter of principle. This is not simply a matter, we don't like you and we like him. If we simply go with him, it looks as if it becomes a personal matter, and then the whole point of the replacement is going to be lost. This is a matter of principle. Now, the next person is Rabbi Akiva. Now, the Gemara here doesn't give us the story, but I know that over the years you've learned or you've heard the great, great inspirational story of Rabbi Akiva, really one of the great... The Talmud is generally not a romantic document. There's not that much romance in the Talmud, but the closest to it is indeed the great story of Rabbi Akiva, who was an ignorant shepherd, who was employed by one of the wealthiest landowners in Yerushalayim, in Eretz Yisrael, whose nickname was Kalba Savua, And kalba sabua literally means a full, a stuffed dog. And dogs never get full, because he was such a hospitable host that even a dog would walk out of his house, you know, stuffed and the like. And kalba sabua was very, very wealthy. And he had a daughter, Rachel. And Rachel fell in love, so to speak, with this ignorant shepherd. She saw in him qualities of greatness, qualities of character. She saw in him midah. She was able to go beneath the gruff, unrefined exterior that such a man had. He was illiterate. And she wanted to marry him. Her father was shocked. Her father wanted somebody from Lakewood, Panovich, you know, he would support him. His daughter's going to marry some ignorant guy who can't even read Hebrew. Was Rabbi Akiva even from? It's not clear. It's not clear, but perhaps he was keeping mitzvahs, but barely. So as a result, he basically told her, he excommunicated her. He basically said, you marry this ignorant man, then you're not my daughter anymore. And he was very wealthy, and he excommunicated her. He made a vow. And she sent Rabbi Akiva to learn Torah. And again, Rabbi Akiva himself was moved by the idea of looking at water going through a rock. And over time, the water could dissolve the rock. And he said himself, you know, the Torah is compared to water. So if water, if physical water, can go through a rock, if it's long enough, then the Torah could permeate my thick skull of a head as well. An amazing thing. So he was over 40 years old. And he went and he learned with first graders, cheder, how to read. And he stayed and he stayed and he stayed and he stayed for 12 years. And after 12 years, all of these years, his wife is living in poverty. Poverty, your father is not taking care of her at all. And she he comes and he overhears her talking to a neighbor, and the neighbor is saying, what type of husband do you have who simply leaves you, he simply abandons you? And she said, I wouldn't mind if he'd go for another 12 years. This is meant in a positive way. And at the end of those, and Rabbi Akiva didn't even say hello. And again, the Sforim say, why didn't he say hello? Why couldn't he have a cup of coffee? And they give two reasons. One reason is that in the learning of Torah, if you interrupt your momentum even a little bit, 2 times 12 is not the same as 1 times 24. The other reason is, and this is very interesting psychologically, if he would have allowed himself to come into his house, he couldn't have made the decision to leave again. He had to be cruel. Now, I do want to point out that this is not a modality that is even permissible for a man to simply leave his wife. We're talking about a woman, a tzedekes, who wanted this. She urged him. It was her desire. And that's why he did it. In fact, it's interesting. I have a biographical speculation, and it's a total speculation. Rabbi Akiva eventually was reunited with his wife, and they lived for many years, and they had children. And according to one tradition, there's a Rabbi Ben Azai who married Rabbi Akiva's daughter. Now, what is interesting about it is the following. It is recorded, though, that Ben Azai got divorced. Now, here is my speculation. The Gemara in Yevamos tells us that Ben Azai himself never wanted to get married. Ben Azai said, Ma Esa, what do you want from me? Nafshi chashka b'Torah. My soul desires to learn Torah. Ben Azai was so connected to the learning of Torah, he didn't want to get married or have children, even though there's a mitzvah pruur v'hu. In fact, in yeshiva, we used to call the older bachelors members of the Ben Azai Club. Yes, Nafsham Chashka B'Torah. So, but Nebuch, there's a mitzvah, gotta get married. So, listen to this. So if you're a Ben Azai mentality, I don't want the distractions of marriage, I don't want the responsibilities of children, I just want to learn, nothing else. But Nebuch, I have to get married. So who are you going to look for? You'll look for a girl who understands that you let your husband go away for 24 years and you don't bother him. So he marries Rabbi Akiva's daughter. But it doesn't work that way. Rabbi Akiva's daughter saw what her mother went through for 24 years. She was not going to take that. This is a total speculation. I don't have any proof for this. But I do have proof. I mean, Tosfos does say Benazai was married to Rabbi Akiva's daughter and they got divorced. That is a text. So I think what I'm suggesting is a very plausible explanation. That if you're Benazai, you want to marry Rachel's daughter. Problem is, Rachel's daughter is not Rachel. She could not do what her mother was able to do. So, Rabbi Akiva, at the end of that 24 years, was now the Gadol Hador. He was not the head of the Sanhedrin, as we see here, but he was the Gadol Hador, the greatest, greatest of the Chachamim. Eventually, of course, he died a martyr's death. But he brought all of these Talmidim, and when this woman that is dressed in rags comes to greet him, the students think she's some crazy person. They block her, and Rabbi Akiva says, Shali v'shaluchem, all that I am and all that you are, Shalahi, is only because of her. Now what's interesting is, after these 24 years, Kalba Savua doesn't know this is his son-in-law. But he heard that he really feels bad about his daughter. It took 24 years. He feels bad about his daughter. He wants to matir his neder. He wants to annul his vow so he could share his wealth with his daughter. So he hears there's this great rabbi that's an expert in the laws of annulling vows. So he goes to this rabbi. Rabbi Akiva recognizes who he is. And he says, you know, I made this vow disinheriting my daughter, but I see she's suffering so much. I just want to forget her. I want to annul the vow. So Rabbi Akiva asked him, and this is what a Beis Din asks, if you would have known that your son-in-law would become a great Talmid Chacham, would you have made the vow? Because if you wouldn't have, then it's a vow by mistake. So he said, a Talmid Chacham, if I would have known, he would have known how to read, I wouldn't have made the vow. So Rabbi Akiva told him, okay, the neder is mutter. You have a Pesach. What's called a Pesach is an opening to the neder. So this was the remarkable story, and that's why Rabbi Akiva and his wife became wealthy, actually. Once he came back after 24 years, they became wealthy with the wealth of Kalba Savua. Of course, there is a tragedy to the story as well. Those 24,000 students were the ones that died in the Sefiras HaOmer period, and of course Rabbi Akiva himself was tortured and died a martyr's death. But okay. But going back to our Gemara here. So Rabbi Akiva, if you're looking for greatness in Torah, he seems to be the good choice. So let's pick Rabbi Akiva. So their conclusion was, and this is a bit enigmatic, again, Rav Kook will have an explanation. Their conclusion was, Rabbi Akiva is certainly worthy, but because Rabbi Akiva does not have distinguished lineage, he does not come from Torah scholars, and in fact, he is actually descended from non-Jews who converted, from Geirim, he does not have what is called Zechus Avos. Okay. Now, here's the question. Why would that be important? Zechus Avos, the merit of your ancestors. Why do you need Zechus Avos? We're looking for a Nasi. Let's pick the best person in the position. First of all, let me remind you that earlier Nasiim, this is before Hillel. Before Hillel was a Nasi, right? Who were the Nasiim before Hillel? The immediate predecessor were Shemaiah and Naphtaliah. Shemaiah and Naphtaliah not only descended from Geirim, they themselves are Geirim. So we don't have this rule, you have to have Yichus to become a Nasi. So what is this inyan of Zechus Avos, and why would it be so important here? So let me give you two explanations. One explanation, let's see if Rashi says it. Yeah, Rashi doesn't say it, but one explanation is the following, and this depends on the Gerasa and the Gemara. Huh? I'm trying to see if to find the Rashi here, 1 second. Yeah, I have a different... Yes, right, yeah, thank you, yeah. Yeah, so Rashi says the following. that when a Talmud Chacham is insulted, now Rabban Gamliel insulted Rabbi Yeshua, but on the other hand, deposing Rabban Gamliel, even for a good reason, is bringing a bizayon, a shame, to Rabban Gamliel. And when a Talmud Chacham is shamed, even if you think it's justifiable, there's an onesh min hashamayim on the person that is connected with shaming him. And therefore, you need some zechus to be saved from that punishment. And one of the zechuyot that can help you in that regard is zechus avos. Since Rabbi Akiva does not have the merit of avos, there is a fear that divine wrath will be kindled against him because of the pagam, because of the pagiyah, in the kavod of Rabban Gamliel. You need somebody that has a certain a bit of immunity, divine immunity, and that can come to some degree with zechus avos. That's how Rashi learns. Rav Kook learns totally different, and again, Rav Kook brings in his idea of leadership, and he says the following. The machlokes, Rabban Gamliel and the Talmidim, is one of, what is the ideal leader? Is the ideal leader autocratic? Kind of creating unity and conformity and community? Or is the idea pluralistic, allowing different voices? So here's what they say. Rav Kook says that precisely when you come from a background of people who are less connected to Torah, you will feel there's a stronger need for a single leadership. Meaning, Rav Kook's idea is that if Rabbi Akiva were to become the Nasi, he would gravitate towards Rabban Gamliel's leadership style. Now again, I can tell you, again from personal experience, that often a Baal Tshuva is confused by a multiplicity of voices. It's hard for them sometimes to grasp. There's this view, and there's this view, and there's this view. They want to know, what's the truth? Someone that has been in the world of Torah a bit longer understands that there are different ways of looking at things, again, within the framework of Torah. Elu v'elu divrei Elokim chayim. In fact, I remember being told by some of the Rosh Hashivas in Or Sameach that certain points should not be discussed, although they are true, because it will confuse our students. Yeah, we could debate how legitimate that is, but it does happen. So, this is what Rav Kook says. If you have zechus avos, meaning it's not so much zechus, the word zechus is a little, doesn't really fit right, but if you come from a family of Talmidei Chachamim, a tradition of Torah, you can understand the notion of pluralism, different views. But if you yourself are a Baal Tshuva, you yourself know there's so much ignorance out there, there's so much confusion out there, you might appreciate the idea that we need to give people single, one-dimensional answers so they won't get mixed up. But that would defeat the whole purpose. If they're replacing Rabban Gamliel, not because of his personal behavior towards Rabbi Yeshua, but because of something inadequate in his leadership style, because Rabbi Akiva himself comes from a background of people who were not learned in Torah, he himself might gravitate to the same autocratic style. And that's why we can't have him. Right? That's Rav Kook's twist in that. So, the third person they choose, or the third person they bring up, and that's the person they choose, is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah has all of the qualities that an ideal Nasi needs. And it mentions three things. He is a Chacham, which is number one. He knows the Torah. He's a great Chacham who understands the Torah. Number two, he is Ashir. He's wealthy. Now this may come as a bit of a surprise. No. Why? He's supposed to be wealthy? First of all, I mean, was Rabbi Akiva wealthy at the time? Maybe Rabbi Akiva was also wealthy at the time based on Kabbalah Savua. So here, the simple explanation is that, there are two possible explanations. There actually was a concept it's not so much applies today, that it is a good thing for a Talmud Chacham who serves a community to have an independent source of wealth. Because when a Rav is dependent on the Kehillah for his parnasa, putting aside the issue of being supported for Torah learning, the Rav's decisions might be affected by his pocketbook. Right? A Rav might be, I'll tell you in the United States, I'll give you horrendous examples. I'm personally aware of a case where a president of a modern Orthodox congregation had a son who wanted to marry a non-Jewish woman. And of course that was inconceivable unless the non-Jewish woman underwent a conversion. But the woman wasn't going to accept the mitzvahs, right? So you can't do a conversion. So the president goes over to the rabbi and says, I want you to convert. I want you to convert this woman. Do an Orthodox conversion so my son can marry her. Because I would never let my son marry a shiksa, right? My son can't marry a guy. Do the conversion. The rabbi refused, rightfully so. The rabbi lost the job. The rabbi was fired. So there is a concept of ashirut. Now, of course, ashirut can corrupt you, of course. But at the same time, ashirut can give you a certain modicum of independence, which can then allow you to make the decisions that need to be made. That's one interpretation. Well, that's an interesting question, but he is allowed to do that. There's no rule that disqualifies. See, a regular judge, you're right, could not adjudicate it as a judge, but a Taurus Nadoran, you can have relatives, you can have all the people who normally cannot participate. Anyway, the point is Rabbi Akiva put in his dues, 24 years of poverty. So one could not really say that he was reluctant to experience that. He put in the sacrifice. Now, the other reason of Ashirut, Rav Kook says, is that the Nasi has two jobs. We discussed this last week. The Nasi was the head of the Sanhedrin. He was the Posek. He was the Torah leader, spiritual leadership. Although he was not necessarily the greatest scholar. Rabbi Akiva was the greatest Talmud Chacham. But the Nasi is, one of the great Talmudei Chachamim. But in addition, the Nasi is the political leader vis-a-vis the Roman Empire. The Nasi was the one who would negotiate with Rome, either in Rome directly with the emperor, or in Caesarea with the Roman governor, whatever it would be. And obviously, the Romans only respected people who had money and clout. And therefore, if you were simply a poor schnorrer who happened to know how to learn Talmud, you would not necessarily make a great impression in the Roman halls of power. So therefore, the Chacham and the Ashir are reflecting the two sides of the Nasi. The Chacham is the Torah leader, and the Ashir is the political leader, who is also needed to negotiate. And again, this is a very delicate time. These are the years after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and relations with Rome are very, very delicate at this point. The third, right, so Chacham, Ashir, and the third, Zechut Avot, Asimi Liezra. He is literally the 10th generation, child after child after child, from the great Ezra. And Ezra, of course, we know about the book of Ezra. Ezra was the great figure who, after the Babylonian exile, at the very beginning of the Second Temple, came to Eretz Yisrael, and he restored religious life. He created the assembly known as the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the people of the Great Assembly, and they did most of our liturgy, and they really created the Takanot that enabled Jewish life to be rebuilt after the Churban. Now, in reality, I would suggest, although Rav Kook doesn't say it directly, that the Asimi Liezra is really addressing two points at once. It is addressing the Zechus Avos point, that his Yichus is so great that he's directly connected to Ezra, as opposed to Rabbi Akiva that didn't have that lineage. But I think there's another point as well. There's something miyuchad about Ezra, because after all, what did Ezra do? He rebuilt Jewish life after the Chorban. That's what Ezra did. What is the job of the Nasi now? Rebuild Jewish life after the Chorban. So if he has the Yichus of Ezra, he is connected to that. He becomes the ideal leader in that way. The greatness of Ezra. Ezra was held in such great regard by the later generations that he was considered to be a second Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gemara actually tells us, had the Torah not been given to Moshe through Moshe Rabbeinu, it would have been given through Ezra. This is how great Ezra was. And in fact, almost as a sign, this is a whole talk in and of itself, almost as a sign that Ezra is able to kind of be Makabel Torah, the Gemara indicates that the Kesav of the Torah was changed in the days of Ezra. That the original writing in the Sifrei Torah before Ezra was the old Hebrew writing, the Kesav Ivri, if you've seen the Kesav Ivri. And the writing that we have in the Sifrei Torah, which is called Kesav Ashurit, that originated in the time of Ezra. And it's a way of symbolically Hashem designating Ezra as a Mekabel HaTorah, that the Torah in the form of the writing that we have. Now, this is a big, big topic. Maybe I'll devote another share to this. And that is, are you telling me that the writing was changed? What about the idea that the Torah is never changeable? Right? The whole fundamental principle that the Torah is eternal. And what about the idea that the Kesav Ashuris was the heavenly Aleph Beis and Shemayim, and you're telling me it dated from the Babylonian exile? Okay, well, we'll talk about that later. But be it as it may, I think there's something very, very symbolic in linking Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to Ezra, because he can be Ezra number two. Ezra number one was after the Chorban Bayis Rishon, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah can be our Ezra number two after the Chorban Bayis Sheni in Yavne. Okay. Say again?
I think his name.
That's correct. Azariah, that is correct. And in fact, there are psukim in Tanakh, in Divrei Hayamim, that mention Azariah, and Chazal say it's Ezra. So Azariah was actually an alternative name for Ezra himself. That's right. Okay. All right. So, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is the dark horse. He's the one that they decide on. He was not anybody's first choice, but once they come to him, he is the one that's the best choice. He's very young, as we'll see, so I'm just continuing the story. So they come and they tell him. Now, it's interesting. It seems that he was not in the room. Right? This is a general rule. Whenever you want to give somebody a job that's very difficult, pick somebody who's not in the room when the appointment is being made. So apparently he was not there for some reason. And they said, would you like to be? Now it's interesting, the Lashon of the Gemara, it's fascinating. It's not 100% clear what job he's being offered. The language in the Gemara is, Nichale Lamar Lemahave Reish Mesifta. Would you like to be the head of the yeshiva? Now as I said, indicated, things are very confusing here because the Nasi has many different jobs that overlap. He is the head of the Sanhedrin, which is a judicial body. He is the head of the main yeshiva, which is mainly a teaching Torah body. He is a political leader. Were they offering him the whole nesiut or only the educational component? On one hand, Rav Kook suggests they were offering him the whole thing because Rav Kook says that was the Maila of Ashiras, is that he could be the political leader. But maybe Rav Kook's explanation is a little difficult because they're not offering him the political position. They're offering him the educational position. So I'm not sure. Maybe these are interchangeable titles. Maybe they use the title that's most important. Yeah, you'll also be involved in politics, but the real... So these are some ambiguities in these stories in terms of what they're actually offering him.
Can't hurt Rosh Yeshiva has money either.
Say again?
Can't hurt if he's an Osho.
You're correct. Now, it doesn't happen that often. But the Bach, for example, of Yael Sirkis, the Bach was a great, great Rav of Krakow, one of the great, great Gedolei HaPoskim in the 1500s. The Bach, I don't know how he was rich, but the Bach was personally wealthy, and he was able to support his own yeshiva. He basically supported 100 Talmidim, he gave them food and lodging. And as a result, the Bach was very independent. Nobody could tell him, you know, what to do and what not to do, because he was not financially dependent on any other person. So, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, as the Jewish husbands should always say, I must go and ask my wife. I cannot take the position without checking with my wife. Rav Kook makes two observations. Rav Kook makes an interesting observation, and again, this is absolutely an autobiographical observation. He says, yes, a person should always ask his wife, but that is because when you serve Klal Yisrael, your family life is going to suffer. Meaning to say, if you wouldn't have to ask your wife because it wouldn't affect your family life, then that means you're not committed enough to the task. Now, there's a person might say, I don't have to ask my wife, I'm going to do this like 3 hours a day, and whatever, it's not going to interfere. If it's not going to interfere, you're not doing the job. If you're doing the job, by definition, it's going to interfere, and therefore your wife has to be a co-partner in enabling you to do it. So she didn't like the idea. She was kind of pragmatic. She said, you know, this is a crazy group. This is a volatile group. They don't like somebody. They impeach him. I never heard of that before. It's like the first time. He says, what if they do it to you? You know, they don't like him. They don't like you. What's going to happen? So he says the following. It is good for a person to use a precious glass. Let's say you have a precious crystal glass. And either it's going to break, you know, or you're only going to use it one day and then somebody takes it away. But to do it for one day is worth it, even if you lose it. Now again, you can interpret this different ways. If you look at things egotistically, yeah, I'd like to cover it even for one day. Covered for a day. I always think about this in terms of the Kohen Gadol. You know, the Kohen Gadol of the Bayis Sheni, every Yom Kippur would go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But in the 420 years of the Bayis Sheni, there were more than 300 Kohanim Gedolim. Now, two Kohanim Gedolim served 40 years each. Shimon HaTzadik, and I don't remember the other one, and Yochanan Kohen Gadol served 80 years. So when you separate it out, take out those years, then each Kohen served less than a year. And the reason is, typically, they died. No. There's a common mistake people make. Many people assume that the Kohen Gadol actually died in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and they even quote a source that they used to put a chain or a rope on his leg to drag the dead body out. That every Yom Kippur, we would drag a rope and have a dead body in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Most sources say that is not true. In other words, he didn't die b'shas maisa, but he didn't live out the year. He died, he had a heart attack later in the year, and the like. It was not on Yom Kippur itself. So here's the issue. If year after year after year after year, the Kohen Gadol dies because he entered the Kodesh HaKadoshim and he was not righteous, then why were people so anxious to get the job? People would vie for the job. The answer is, this is what kavod is. Each person says, I get to go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and maybe I get to live and then I become this great hero. People risk their lives for, you know, all the time, right? They, whatever it is, they walk across Niagara Falls on a tightrope or whatever. They do things that risk their lives because maybe they'll make it. So kavod is a very powerful motivator. People risk their lives for kavod all the time. But once again, Rav Kook says, Elizabeth Azariah, Tzaddik, we don't impute those types of base motives. So Rav Kook says exactly the opposite point. He says like this, if you're in it for the kavod, then you're not going to take a job where you might be humiliated. I'm doing it for the honor. Well, if there's a chance they're going to turn against me, I don't want that because I'm not going to get the honor and respect. But if you take a job for the good that you can accomplish, then okay, I have the job for a day. There are good things I can do even for one day. Meaning, I don't care if they humiliate me afterwards, because there's a precious role that I could fulfill and I can do good. So Rav Kook, see, he turns it on its face. When a person is not in it for the glory, then he doesn't care if he'll be fired afterwards. If I can do good for 24 hours, then I will do good for 24 hours. And therefore, he told his wife, I'm going to take the job. And the problem is, of course, we know this part of the story. He was only 18 years old, etc. He turned prematurely old. We will continue this. So again, as I say, this is a very rich story, so we're going to continue next week as well with the same story. So you don't need a new source sheet. So say, what's going on? Thank you so much.